What you are about to hear is not.
Not
a podcast. This is a global conversation recorded live in real time with real people.
Journalists,
business leaders,
academics, politicians. I think the term's a deep state.
Oh dear.
Investors,
experts, diplomats,
citizens.
Coming together from around the world to share their views and ask our guests the questions. If you would like to join this conversation or hear our incredible library of past conversations, please visit our website, pm101.club, and join the fastest growing conscious community on the free internet. Thanks for being here.
Enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Politics and Media 101. I'm Jeff Browning, and if you listened to our first few episodes, then you know that over the last few months, my friend Justin Higgins and I and our friends have convened hundreds of conversations, sometimes more than once per day, with up to 30,000 live listeners and participants, where we hear live and direct from people in the news, in their own voices, in their own words, in long form, and where anyone who wants to can join to ask them a question, share their thoughts, or just listen. We're just now starting to release recorded portions of our live conversations for the first time, and we're grateful to you for joining us. Today, we're excited to release part of a conversation, interview, and audience Q&A we had with Sungmin Kim of The Washington Post. She spent more than 10 years covering Congress up close, first as a reporter at Politico, focusing primarily on immigration policy, and now at The Washington Post. Every day, she watches the relationship between President Biden and Congress very, very closely, analyzes the personalities and events involved, and uses her expertise to write articles that explain this to the public. If you listened to our earlier episode with Senator Warner, or if you watch the news, then you know right now Congress and the Biden administration are considering some very big legislative items. The first is a bipartisan infrastructure bill that would spend about $1.2 trillion to fix America's roads, bridges, ports, internet infrastructure, railways, and more. The second is a bigger, separate bill, potentially up to $3.5 trillion. This second bill is where many of President Biden's core priorities live. It would invest in a lot of things that could really impact people's lives across the country, and unlike the infrastructure bill, this second bill is not supported overall by Republicans or even by all Democrats. Democrats control 50 votes in the Senate, and they're working to pass this bill using a special process called reconciliation, which allows them to pass it with just 50 votes, instead of the 60 votes they'd normally need to pass most things under the Senate rules. Of course, Republicans don't like this, and in many ways, much of President Biden's agenda, many of the items that really do impact our lives, hang in the balance. Sungmin is really close to all of this, and the expertise she shared with us was very timely. We had great audience questions, and we hope you enjoy it. As always, if you like or dislike what you hear, if you want to find out how to join us live almost every day of the week, maybe ask one of our upcoming guests a question, or hear past episodes, please visit our website, pm101.live or pm101.club. They both work and will get you to the same place where you can find all that and more. Without any further ado, let's roll the tape.
You've covered a couple of different White Houses here in Congresses. What's the difference between covering the White House in Congress from the Trump administration to the Biden administration? Specifically, are the relationships you have with sources fundamentally different? And do the two administrations require different strategies for cultivating sources? Is it harder to cultivate sources now than it was, or explain that dynamic to us.
Hi, everyone. Well, first of all, thanks for having me and looking forward to the conversation. So there are some significant differences between obviously this administration and the last in terms of kind of my beat coverage, which is anything that anything where there is that intersection of Capitol Hill and the White House, whether it comes to on what, you know, whether it involves, you know, policy, legislative fights, nomination fights, relationship stories, the personalities involved and the characters. There's certainly a difference between the way this current White House interacts and does its dealings with Congress and, of course, the last administration. in its relationship, or very oftentimes the lack thereof, with Capitol Hill. So it's certainly the Biden White House has a more traditional approach to Congress. It reminds me a lot of kind of the way that things occurred under the Obama administration and its relationships with Capitol Hill. Although with President Biden, I think his administration, his legislative affairs shop, his top officials have gotten much higher marks from even the Obama administration in terms of how they respond and cultivate these relationships on Capitol Hill, which has been really interesting for me. And that's kind of, it's pretty clear why that is and why there is such a premium of why President Biden himself places such high priority on those relationships. And it's because he is a creature of Capitol Hill. Obviously, he served in the Senate for 36 years. And every single time he talks about the Senate, he talks about it so fondly and with a lot of memories. And he loves coming back to the Senate when he can, or hosting senators in the Oval Office at the White House. So covering a president who really is a creature of Capitol Hill, which is a place that I've covered predominantly for 10 years, has been really interesting. A lot of times, you know, with Trump and Capitol Hill, there was an often antagonistic relationship, even with members of his own party. The way that Trump communicated with lawmakers was very interesting. You know, I tell people that I spent, you know, half my days basically chasing around the hallways looking for Lindsey Graham and ask him when the last time he talked with President Trump on the phone, and what does President Trump think on XYZ topics. So there is that difference as well. And in terms of sources, I think kind of the general consensus on from the broader White House press corps about this, you know, White House, the people who are within the walls of the White House versus the last one, is that it is a much tighter operation. Obviously, you don't have a lot of these leaks that we saw basically every day coming from the Trump White House. And obviously in the Trump White House, there were a lot of internal competing factions, which, you know, members of which would leak out their sides of the story to the media to kind of spin things in their favor. So you saw a lot of dissension internally within the Trump White House, and that, and you get less of that kind of palace intrigue with this current White House. The Biden White House, in terms of being a source in other ways, are a lot more professionalized in terms of, you know, hosting background calls with top administration officials ahead of a major policy announcement, providing briefings, you know, embargoed information. So sources in that way, obviously, much different and much more coordinated than the Trump White House. But it's different in a lot of ways. And it's been fun covering and interesting covering both the Trump White House and the Biden White House so far.
That is awesome. So I kind of wanted to follow up. You gave us the line. You did, Sungmin. Biden is a creature of the Senate. We hear that all the time. So I love it. But I wanted to ask you about the difference between now Biden and President Obama, and specifically looking at how President Obama took a slow, methodical approach to healthcare, really ended up hurting him and the Democratic platform for a decade, at least with Obamacare, due to that slow approach, and also how he kind of neglected Congress or approached Congress. And can you contrast that with what Biden is doing, maybe with the American Relief Act and the way he is engaging Congress? Has Biden learned from the mistakes of the Obama administration? And which administration do you think is more effective legislating?
So the one lesson that, you know, veterans of the Obama White House or that, you know, the current Biden White House officials have definitely taken away from the lessons of the first couple of years of the Obama administration is that time is of the essence. And they mostly point to attempts by the Obama administration and senior Democrats to negotiate with some key swing Republicans, particularly in the Senate, when it came to their healthcare overhaul. And they feel that at the end of the day, it was just months wasted courting these votes that ultimately never materialized. And they really, at some point, they really had to kind of negotiate out and, you know, and deal with and resolve the internal factions within their own caucuses, even though House Democrats had a large majority. And at one point during Obama's first term, he did have 60 votes in the Senate, which seems like such an unlikely number to reach for either party these days because of how polarized the polarized the country is. So that was definitely a lesson that they that Democrats took away. And really, at some points, you know, when the situation necessitated it, decided that negotiations weren't worth it with Republicans. So obviously, with the American Rescue Plan that you referenced earlier, Biden, President Biden had a couple of these, you know, meetings with, you know, Oval Office meetings with Republican senators, which were very heavily covered. But basically, you know, the next day, they kind of, you know, Democrats decided to kind of move on their own and pass the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package on their own because they felt that negotiating with Republicans was just kind of a waste of time. But on certain things, when things are a little less urgent, I think bipartisanship has really been important to the president. And you saw that with the infrastructure legislation that 10 Democrats and Republicans in the Senate negotiated and ultimately struck a deal with the administration in late July, might have been early August. I'm trying to remember the calendar dates. And that was a really important signal that President Biden wanted to send not only to the country, but to the world. And I think in that sense, President Biden does seem a little bit different from President Obama in just how much he values bipartisanship. He, President Biden and his top aides have talked about how it is just so important for negotiations like these and these types of bipartisan accomplishments, not only just to get stuff done for the country, but to send a signal to the world that this is still a functioning democracy, that things and very important things can happen in the United States government across party lines for the good of the American people. And that's why stuff, things like the bipartisan infrastructure deal was so critical to the president beyond just fixing roads and expanding broadband and a lot of the other provisions that that the legislation would do. I know a lot of Democrats privately said during the Obama administration and even privately say now that they felt the Obama White House didn't care as much about Congress. And I think that is a difference that you do see with President Biden. I think on a lot of his priorities, you can't argue that he's not a fan of Congress and he cherishes the relationships there and that he really sees members of Congress, especially on a lot of these key priorities, as a valuable negotiating partner.
Basically, all of Biden's agenda is sitting right now in Congress with the reconciliation and infrastructure. For everybody in the audience, if you're not in DC, the reconciliation bill is the progressive bill written largely by Bernie Sanders, which has $3.5 trillion in spending. It increases health, it expands healthcare. It has some green climate change issues. It increases social safety nets. And then there's about a $1.2 trillion, we can get into the specifics on the funding, transportation bill, which Sungmin had just mentioned was a bipartisan bill. Can you, without going into too much detail, this basically is Biden's, the bulk of Biden's agenda. Can you explain to us where it sits right now? And is there any type of hard timeline deadline, or is it just hurting the cats?
A lot of it is hurting the cats in an attempted deadline, if you will. But although, as always, those deadlines can shift. If you want to be technical, the President Biden's big domestic policy agenda, let's call it that, because there's so much packed into these two bills. Technically, it's about 1/4 of the way there. One of the bills, the infrastructure bill, has passed the Senate and it's just kind of waiting for action in the House. And what makes this process so complicated is that, you know, as we talked about earlier, some of his infrastructure ambitions, which is a big part of his domestic policy agenda, is in this bipartisan bill, which got many Republican votes, not just the bare minimum, the 60 votes that are needed, and not just the negotiators, but even Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader. So there's that one part. And then all of the other stuff. So you're talking about, you know, expanding Medicare benefits, free community college, universal pre-K, paid leave, immigration, although that's kind of that's up in the air right now. That's all packed into this separate package that can be passed. It's supposed to be mainly a budgetary bill, but parties, you know, both political parties, Democrat and Republican, have used this process to pass major party priorities, such as the Affordable Care Act on the final version back during the Obama years, as well as the 2017 tax cuts under the Trump administration under the Republican Congress. So the Democrats right now are trying to pack a lot, you know, almost all of their domestic policy priorities in this separate package. And it is so tough for many reasons. First of all, it's just a really big bill that they're trying to put between, that they're trying to craft in a short amount of time, a relatively short amount of time, and within the parameters of these really tricky Senate budget rules. And we've already had news last night with the Senate parliamentarian, who's kind of like the Senate referee, especially for these budget rules, saying immigration reform doesn't really count in this package. Senate Democrats are going to keep trying, but right now it was a pretty big blow for Democrats' efforts to put immigration, a pathway to legal status, in this immigration package. So that's one of the major difficulties. And if you combine that with just the really narrow majorities that Democrats have, obviously no vote to spare in the Senate and only about three or four votes to spare in the House, which are really, really small majorities. And complicating all of that even more is that you have factions, you have the moderate faction in the Democratic caucus versus the progressive faction in the Democratic caucus saying they won't vote for the other bill without their own priorities moving. And it's so it's just basically each side and each side within the Democratic caucus are holding the other party priority hostage so they can get their own bill across the finish line. House Democratic leaders have eyed September 27th as a potential date to get both bills done. There's no way that is happening in the Senate, particularly. House also appears really difficult. So that September 27th deadline looks very difficult right now. We assume that it'll take even longer, even just for Senate Democrats to work out their own differences when it comes to the corporate tax rate, how high should that go, or the prescription drug rules. There's just a lot of internal party divisions to work out in such a short amount of time that it's hard to see how this all happens by the end of the month.
That is very true. And I wanted to follow up. You were on Twitter, and I'm ashamed to admit, I saw you when you broke this on Twitter. So I spend a lot of time following you and all the other political reporters. But very good job. It was all over the place after you broke it that the White House was meeting with Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. So I guess for the audience, I want to ask a little bit different of a question here. First question is, are those two the main holdouts, or is there anyone else that might surprise us? Because we only hear about these two. We only hear about big, bad Joe Manchin and awful Kyrsten Sinema, right? So is there anybody else that's maybe not making too much waves in the media that could sink this bill? And for the audience, Joe Manchin has also said that he wants to just put the reconciliation bill on the ice until 2022, reported by Axios, and he only wants to go up to $1.5 trillion. So is he actually willing to negotiate, or is he willing to sink it all?
Well, first of all, we call the duo Manchinima on Capitol Hill or Sinema. There's a debate within the press corps which we like better, Manchinima or Cinemanchin, but I think either way works. I prefer Manchinima. I think it kind of rolls off the tongue a little bit better. But certainly those are the two Democratic senators, because they are on the more moderate, some would even say conservative end of the Democratic caucus. And this, you know, at least the initial plan as it was laid out, is one of the most progressive, ambitious policy measures in generations, that they are really the ones being watched here in terms of their policy priorities and what they are comfortable with. So, but the thing is, in a 50-50 Senate, I know there's a lot of, you know, Democratic complaints about all the attention that's put on Senators Manchin and Sinema. And, you know, Democratic senators have, trust me, have complained privately as well, is that in a 50-50 Senate, any one senator can be the kingmaker or be the holdout and has all that leverage to get what he or she wants in the way that's best for their constituents and, you know, dealing with those parochial home state interests or for any sort of political ambitions. You know, we talk, obviously, there's a lot of, there are a lot of concerns, obviously, that have been reported about what Senators Manchin and Sinema have with the initial kind of $3.5 trillion blueprint. But there are some kind of smaller landmines that Democratic leaders are having to contend with. You know, the pharmaceutical changes that we referenced earlier. You know, there have been concerns from, for example, Senators Bob Menendez and Tom Carper, both Democratic senators, both obvious, you know, allies and want to do, both people who want to do accomplish the domestic policy goals of the Biden administration. They have concerns about those provisions. You know, Senator John Tester hasn't always been comfortable with the $3.5 trillion top line. And there are a lot of, or not a lot, but enough House members who say, if this is not in, I am not going to vote for it. For example, Congressman Chuy Garcia from Illinois has said that if immigration can't be included in this bill, I will not vote for it. So there's, you know, depending on how things shake up with immigration policy provisions at the end of the day, that could be a dangerous, you know, point or a concerning point for House Democratic leadership. And a handful of House Democrats who represent sort of these high tax states. So if you think New York, New Jersey, California, they've raised concerns about the state and local tax deduction that the Trump tax legislation in 2017 eliminated. They want to bring some of that deductions back so their constituents' tax bills aren't hurt so much. They want to bring those, you know, one has gone so far to say, Tom Suozzi, a Democrat from New York, has said no salt, no deal. And he has been pretty adamant in saying that if this, you know, state and local tax deduction isn't restored in some fashion through this big, massive, you know, bill, then he would not support it either. So you do see how there are these, you know, various landmines kind of, you know, scattered all over the place for, you know, House leaders, Senate leaders, and the White House. You know, obviously, you know, Manchin and Sinema get a lot of the ink, but there are a lot of concerns that have to be addressed throughout the House Democratic Caucus and the Senate Democratic Caucus.
Maybe the best nickname ever uttered on Politics and Media 101, Manchinima. I love it.
I can't take credit for it. I think it was one of my colleagues who came up with that during a brainstorming session, and we're trying to make it stick.
I think you've made it stick on our show, and hopefully we'll speak to one of them and be able to call them that. So right. When it's all said and done, I do want to parlay into some of the other crap that Biden has been dealing with this September. But when it's all said and done, tell us, level with us. We're just a bunch of friends. Is this going to pass? And is this just, you know, how it gets darkest before it gets light? Is that what we're experiencing right now?
That's a really interesting question. And I've just kind of operated on the assumption, and Democratic sources have told me this too, that this is like failure is not an option here for Democrats. What was so interesting is that, you know, when so much focus was on voting rights legislation and trying to get that passed through Congress, Chuck Schumer said at the time that failure is not an option when it comes to voting rights. But we kind of know that failure is an option. And it's because of that filibuster that where that rule, the Senate rule that requires 60 votes for nearly any legislation and resistance resistance from moderate Senate Democrats to effectively blow that up to pass things like voting rights, you know, abortion legislation, immigration, and other kind of major policy measures. But on this one, there really is a recognition that Democrats, particularly in the first year of the Biden presidency, really do have to deliver something for voters and need kind of that marquee legislation that they, you know, that they pass, they sign into law, that they come back and really, you know, tout to their constituents, especially ahead of the 2022 midterms, because we know that the 2022 midterms are going to be pretty difficult for Democrats. You know, the first midterm of any, you know, president is always a very tough one. We saw how President Obama lost 63 seats in the House. Obviously, you know, in 2018, with President Trump's first midterms, Democrats won back the House and he got himself a Democratic House that successfully impeached him twice. So you do see how that first midterm of presidency historically is just not good for the White House, the party in power of the White House. And then if you combine that with all the redistricting issues and the narrow majority that House Democrats enjoy, I think the safe bet, obviously we're more than a year out, is that Republicans would win back the majority this fall. So knowing all those factors and dealing with the difficult political headwinds, Democrats really do need these key policy wins to come back home, you know, tell their constituents, this is what a Democratic Congress and a Democratic White House got you. So that's why, even though we're seeing a lot of threats right now from various members and various factions, there is very little clarity on just how various policy provisions or the big top line or the corporate tax rate, like all that is so unclear right now. I think Democrats broadly know that this is kind of their one big shot to enact their party's goals. There doesn't seem to be an actual sense to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So that's the sense right now. We'll see what happens once we get closer to the finish line and see if what kind of the compromise product that emerges is really a deal breaker for certain members of the caucus. But I think there is this really big pressure on Democratic lawmakers, on the Biden White House, to get something done.
I have about 4 minutes of questions left, and then we're going to you, the audience. So let's keep it going. With Biden's no good, absolutely terrible September, he's had Afghanistan, he's had Hurricane Ida, he's had surging COVID, he's had culture and, you know, physical fights throughout the country about masks and vaccine mandates, and now there's a Haitian refugee crisis. Has these, obviously these struggles have put a urgency under the administration to pass the two pieces of legislation we were just talking about, but I want to know from your sources, do they view the dip in approval rating, which Biden has suffered, and it's pretty serious, and all of these crises as a temporary setback, or do they view this as something that could be more fatal heading into 2022?
I think there's a sense that, first of all, it's very early in terms of how voters and what that mood is going to be, you know, when voters go to the polls in November 2022. And I think that In many senses, and depending on what issue we're talking about, the Biden White House does seem to be playing kind of the long game here. So, for example, there's a lot of controversy or a lot of pushback from conservatives over, for example, the vaccine mandates that the White House laid out a couple of weeks ago. I believe it was, earlier this month, in terms of the business mandates and the mandates for federal workers. And, you know, a lot of complaints from conservatives and Republican lawmakers that this is basically a government overreach. But at the same time, the Biden White House knows that their presidency in so many ways will be judged on how he handles the pandemic. And so if these mandates in the long run, you maybe get some, you know, short-term political pushback now from Republican elected officials. But if in the long run it helps people get vaccinated and hopefully end this pandemic earlier, that is a major, you know, not only a policy win for the administration, but a political win as well. And you've also seen, and they look at polling where it says the majority of the American public do favor mandates for certain activities. And I think they're with Afghanistan as well. For example, they are looking broader and pointing to the fact that, for example, you know, setting aside the botched withdrawal. And obviously, I think there has been criticism from, you know, all corners about how the withdrawal was handled last month. They are looking to the fact that, you know, the majority of Americans do believe that it was time for U.S. involvement in Afghanistan to end, and that this was really delivering on a promise, a deeply held view by President Biden that he has had for a long time. And they're kind of hoping that the long game there, you know, helps President Biden out in the end. So we'll see if those kind of predictions pan out. The political environment is just so fickle, obviously. So what voters may care about now versus what they may care about in November 2022 is hard to say. But I think right now it's pretty safe to say that COVID will still be a relatively high factor in the minds of voters. And I think they really did take solace in Governor Gavin Newsom's resoundly beat back the recall efforts in California last week. And you heard, and they saw that, you know, in a big way as kind of a validation for the really tough measures that Governor Newsom took to defeat the pandemic. And that is something that White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki talked about the next day as kind of a lesson, one of the White House's takeaways. So they're taking kind of these off-year elections where Democratic, you know, candidates and Democratic gubernatorial or governors are really running on their handling of COVID, and hoping that translates into next year's midterms and in their own handling of the pandemic.
So, folks, we are going to the best part of this, the audience questions. On that note, I'm going to call on two people that will show you how it's done. We're going to Ben Rhodes' biggest supporter, Jim, and then we're going to go to Ab. Jim, over to you.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. Sung Min, it's a pleasure to hear from you. The Washington Post is my daily rag every day for about 10 years, and still one of the few major papers I subscribe to, even being outside the area. So I applaud your work and the work of the Post. Quick question for you, and I realize this is kind of broad, but would appreciate any thoughts you have on it. I kind of harbor a personal feeling that we've had a real challenge in our legislature and in the executive branch with regards to their policy and their agenda, really over the last 10 years, kind of back to the ACA, where more and more legislative initiatives based on the administration's agenda were derived and satisfied as part of one big omnibus bill, instead of broken up into more of the series of legislations, especially legislations that were tied to agency funding. And so we've been caught more and more in this cycle of continuing resolutions, those continuing resolutions leading to drop dead dates to get omnibus bill passed, things crammed in, just like we were talking about for the infrastructure bill dealing with immigration, because it seems like having a kind of Pacific War island hopping strategy for achieving a legislative agenda isn't something we can do anymore. And we've been forced to take like a Normandy approach to do it all at once and die on the hill with it. I'd appreciate any of your thoughts just because you're kind of closer to it on a day-to-day basis. Thank you.
Right. That's such an excellent point to raise. And it's kind of a hard one to get across because obviously people care about results and getting things done. You know, both members of the public and lawmakers on Capitol Hill. But you know, senators I've talked to privately just note that this reconciliation legislation alone touches on so many policy areas, at least a dozen, if you count healthcare, taxes, education. There's just so much packed into this bill. And each one of the policy areas, you know, could and honestly, you know, frankly, deserves kind of its own fulsome public debate, public, public airing of, the best ways to enact this policy, instead of trying to kind of rush all this through by September 27th, which I, again, like I said earlier, I'm skeptical it happens, but that is a goal that is set by the leadership. Immigration alone is a major story about efforts to get that done. I had a job, one of my beats back in 2013 and 2014, especially in the early, the early kind of half year of 2013, was just covering the Senate immigration bill and the process and all the different changes that it would make and how it was winding its way through the Senate and all the politics and policy and background maneuvering that was involved. And any one of these policy areas alone is a massive policy change. So it's hard for, frankly, it's hard for reporters to be able to, explain all that in concise ways and digestible ways to the public. I'm not sure anyone would argue that stepping all these major major changes that have such an impact on people's lives is the best way to legislate. But that's kind of what has happened over the last, many years. The annual appropriations process, where lawmakers fund the 12 government agencies, hopefully before the deadline at the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, that process has all but broken down over the last, 20 years or so. So you're right. Things are packed into, first of all, either these massive omnibus bills that come together at the last minute, usually in December when everyone is wanting to go home for the holidays and leadership is trying to use that kind of holiday fatigue to pressure people to come to a deal. So you have all these bills that no one, barely anyone has read. So you have that process, or you have continuing resolutions, which is going to be very likely at the end of this month to keep the government funded, that, for example, keeps the policies of the previous administration and the top line spending levels of the previous administration. So that doesn't necessarily, make people who are in charge now happy, but oftentimes it's the only way to act. It's the only way to avert a government shutdown at the end of the day. So in terms of actual policymaking, legislating, the kind of work that we all kind of learned about in our social studies courses and government classes, it doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't really exist anymore. And it's hard in so many respects to cover this, to make sure that we, give it the attention that it deserves so the public can understand. But we all kind of obviously, whether it's staffers or members or advocates or reporters, we all kind of try to do our best in such a shortened timeline and all this and under this constant crunch of deadlines.
Folks, I just want to remind everybody, Sungmin Kim wrote a great article about the Biden administration increasing the refugee and immigration caps, rather, to 125,000. So that might be something to ask about. But we will go to Ab, Tom, and then Aram. Ab, over to you.
Thank you, Justin. Thanks for having me, Sungmin. It's been a wonderful conversation. My question to you is, what is President Biden's approach? Like, what is his view on executive action usage, because it's been well documented that President Obama used executive order because of a lot of the gridlock that was happening in Congress and the inability to get things through. So if these packages do not go through, is that something that he'll use along with the Justice Department, and especially in lieu of the possible Supreme Court hearing the Mississippi challenge to abortion?
That's a really interesting question. And I think the Biden White House's approach to executive orders has really been one of this can only kind of complement what Congress can do. It cannot replace legislative action. So obviously, on the first day of his presidency, on day one, on January 20th, President Biden signed a blizzard of executive orders on so many different policy areas, whether it's immigration. Immigration is kind of the big one that I remember, but he did so many other areas, climate, rejoining the Paris deal, that in an attempt to undo by himself what a lot of what President Trump had done under the previous administration. But over and over, as this White House and as this president rolls out executive orders, whether it's on guns or abortion or voting rights, they all combine it. They all, you know, emphasize that this does not replace congressional action. And this is, you know, we can, and, you know, the administration by itself can only go so far. So, for example, on abortion, obviously the Justice Department can challenge a lot of these abortion challenges in court, but only, for example, members of Congress can codify Roe versus Wade into law, which seems like a very unlikely proposition because, again, you would need 60 votes in the Senate to make this happen. You know, when President Biden rolled out a lot of executive orders related to guns, I believe back in April, you know, they had, you know, they could do, you know, they could do directives such as, again, directing the Justice Department to draft regulations regulating these ghost guns, which are basically, as I understand it, kind of like a, you know, put the pieces together and make your own firearms at home type of weapons. You know, they felt they could do that under their executive authority. But in terms of implementing tougher background checks for firearm sales, they said, no, we believe that this is something that only Congress can do. One of the big areas where the Biden White House has gotten pushback for doing something on its own, whereas before they, after indicating that they felt that they didn't have the power to do on their own, that it was really Congress's job, was actually this eviction moratorium that expired earlier this year. And basically, the Supreme Court had indicated that this would need to be something that is legislatively extended by Congress, that this eviction moratorium that was essentially implemented by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The White House had made it clear that they believe this was in Congress's court to act. Congress, especially progressive Democratic lawmakers, pushed back, said, no, we believe that this is something that the White House can do on its own. And even though they publicly disagreed, a few days later, after the eviction moratorium expired, the White House found a new legal reasoning and released a new eviction moratorium that they felt could survive court muster, which obviously then was promptly challenged by opponents of extending the eviction moratorium, such as an association representing landlords. So that's one example where it was kind of difficult on their end in terms of the executive action and balancing that with what Congress's responsibilities are. But in an overall sense, on these really hot button issues, the Biden administration has tried to make it clear that there really is a limit to what they can do just on his own.
Thank you for that question, Ab. We will go to Tom, Andrea, and then Megan.
Hey, so thanks for having me up here today, Justin. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming to answer questions. I have I'll ask your opinion about what you think about the precious treatment from this administration and access and willingness to take questions since Joe Biden has taken office compared to the Trump administration. I know you kind of talked a little bit at the beginning about the differences between the two. But do you think that you wish that you had more access some days and that he was taking more questions and talking to the press more, especially outside of news conferences where, you know, you'd see President Trump just sit down and talk outside the White House several times before he'd hop on Marine One, just sit there and talk to reporters for 2, 3, 4 minutes. You know, you just don't see that a lot with Joe Biden, I don't think at all. Do you expect to see any of that in the next 2 to 3 years while we still have him here? Or do you expect to see less access as we move along here? And are you disappointed? Or what is your take on all of that as far as access with this administration compared to the prior administration and how it makes your work either easier or harder?
I will say, well, first of all, with the caveat that there will never be enough access for reporters when it comes to the president or his top aide. So we're always going to want to push for more. You know, us reporters will probably never be fully satisfied. With that said, I will say that I have been surprised at how often President Biden does take questions off the cuff from reporters when it is not in a formal news setting, because as you probably know, President Biden only has had one formal news conference that was billed as a news conference where his aides said he would take questions on any sort of topic and did not have kind of this preset, agenda or a big policy proposal to roll out. So even though he has only held one formal press conference, he does take questions, you know, whether it's in a pool spray where he's meeting with, you know, various officials on X topic of the day, or when he leaves to do Marine One. Obviously, he does not talk as much as President Trump did on a lot of these chopper talks. But I think maybe my expectation of how often President Biden himself would speak to reporters in these kinds of candid situations was, I just figured that maybe he would talk as much as President Obama did, which in these candid conversations, which was not very much. And he has done more than I would expect. So that is good. Obviously, like I said, we are always going to want more. We're going to want more formal press conferences. I will point out that President Biden has not done an interview with a newspaper. We know he's an avid newspaper reader, so we would love it if he would talk to the Washington Post or other very good and capable print reporters in the White House press corps. But there have been obviously several times over the last several days, especially when the Biden administration has had a pretty bad run when it comes to, you know, the FDA and boosters or the drone strikes or other issues, where we would have liked to have had, you know, questions asked of President Biden himself and questions answered, and that he did, you know, ignore the press and didn't answer and didn't engage with us. So it is always going to be kind of a push and pull with a president in terms of us wanting our questions answered. The other thing I will point out, too, is just the resumption of the daily press briefings under Jen Psaki, which was not at all, by no means, a consistent feature of the Trump White House. So even though President Trump talked to us, you know, at, you know, so much, whether it was under the wing of Air Force One or, you know, on before he left for Marine One or in these cabinet meetings with cabinet officials, his aides rarely took questions, particularly in the latter half of the administration in these formal daily press briefings. So Stephanie Grisham, one of the White House press secretaries under Trump, never held a formal press briefing. Her successor, Kayleigh McEnany, was pretty sporadic as well. I remember her, I believe it must have been her final press briefing, if you can call it that, which was immediately after the January 6th insurrection, where the White House had announced that they would hold a briefing, but basically, you know, it was a time for Kayleigh to come out, say basically a 90-second prepared statement and leave while all of us were like just screaming questions at her about, you know, President Trump and particularly the aftermath of the riots at the Capitol. So in terms of access to, you know, having that communication with his top press officials in a formal televised setting where we can ask a litany of questions and have these events where we can hold the officials accountable and put them on the record, that's been really helpful and really nice to have resumed under this administration.
So we will be going next to Andrea and then Megan and then Aram, who I unfortunately forgot. But Andrea, over to you.
Thank you, Justin. I have a question turning globally now, and was wondering if you could comment on the White House, maybe the inside scoop on the White House position on our return to the global stage, and knowing that that has been somewhat rocky with recent geopolitical events, but we have the United Nations General Assembly happening. We have the G20 coming up in October in Italy, and then we have the Conference of the Parties 26 happening in November after that. And it has been said by Secretary Blinken and I believe President Biden himself that we are at a time where obviously there is a lot to take care of at home, recovering from a global pandemic, economic recovery, and addressing systemic racism, among many other things, and voting rights, suppression of voting rights. So I'm wondering if you could comment on, at a time when we need to do all this work at home, there's a lot of pressure for a return to the global stage in real cooperation and allyship. I was wondering if you could shed some further insight. Thank you.
Right. No, there's certainly a lot of challenges, both on the domestic and foreign policy front, that this White House is dealing with. Obviously, you're right. You know, especially this was a huge theme of President Biden and this White House on its first big foreign trip to the G7 back in June, that this was really, you know, the United States's return to the global stage. This was obviously a signal that they wanted to send early on by, for example, on day one, returning to the Paris Climate Accords that President Trump withdrew from under his term, and kind of building on that theme through every sort of foreign policy venue that they have, especially in these multilateral events. And certainly I would expect that would be a similar theme, you know, in the G20 in Rome and in a lot of these other summits as well. I think one challenge that kind of melds the two issues that you talked about, domestic and foreign, that one kind of goal, even if the White House won't say it out loud, is trying to, when he attends these events, to try to come with credibility by being able to show progress on certain fronts back at home. And I think that kind of dueling imperatives is the most clear with the COP26 summit in Glasgow. The White House kind of signaled, although they didn't really we didn't really pin them down on it, the White House signaled that they would like to see progress on this reconciliation legislation that we've spent a lot of time talking about before President Biden goes to the climate summit in early November. Because this legislation has so much climate provisions, and that's actually a huge part. I mean, talk about the parts we didn't talk about earlier, climate and how Democrats and the White House want to deal with the climate issue is such a huge part of the reconciliation legislation. And I think the White House would love nothing more for President Biden to be able to go to COP26 and tout all this action, progressive action on the climate front from the U.S. Congress. You know, they never said that, they didn't say, yes, President Biden would like to see the sign of the law by early November. I think they know that that is a challenge at this point. But certainly that would be a major win that the president can take to the COP26 summit. And just on a broader level, and you touched on this too in your question, is that while the president has, you know, had a broader theme of just the United States being or broader mission of ensuring that the United States is engaged globally again, especially after 4 years of President Trump. You know, what happened last week with France and the recalling of the ambassador, which I believe was the first time since 1778, so it's been quite a long time, has been kind of a black mark on that front. And I think that's something that certainly, if you're talking about the stream of bad news for the administration, certainly not a good one, that not a good development that the president has had over the last several days, especially as he faced several other challenges on both the domestic and foreign policy fronts. And I think we're really going to be watching the call with French President Emmanuel Macron if and when that happens. The White House has made it clear that they want to have some sort of a call and that they're arranging one. So how that call goes will certainly be watched very closely, and whether he's able to smooth over what has been a pretty big rift between one of our oldest allies.
We will go to Megan and then Aram for probably the last two questions, and we'll kick it over to Sung Min for last words, and then we'll do our focus group. So Megan is a former Capitol Hill staffer for the Republicans and Trump appointee. Megan, over to you.
Thanks, Justin. And thank you so much for coming and joining us tonight. I'll start by just giving my periodic occasional reminder that a salt cap repeal benefits primarily the top 1% of earners.
Thank you for the reminder. Several others are echoing that as well during the salt debate on Capitol Hill.
It is a drum that I will continue to beat, that every Democrat that advocates for its repeal is a giant hypocrite. But my question relates to some of the healthcare provisions of the reconciliation package. I'd really like to hear your take. Lots of things that are in there, extending the Obamacare tax credits, drug pricing reform, dental vision and hearing, Medicaid gap, all of these things. What do you think has the best chance of staying in, and what do you think might get put on the chopping block?
That is such a good question. And we've actually been asking a lot of this because obviously Democrats are going to shoot for the sun, moon, and stars and try to pack everything into this legislation. But they do have a certain cap on, you know, first of all, how high the overall price tag can go, considering the concerns from Manchin and Sinema and other moderates, and also just how high the healthcare provisions can go. And I actually asked Jen Psaki this in the White House briefing room, I believe it was last week or the week before, that if and when, maybe when the administration has to make a choice between, for example, shoring up the Affordable Care Act and expanding Medicare benefits, which side are they going to land on? And Jen didn't bite. She said they're not going to negotiate that from there. But I do certainly think that that is a really, well, it certainly is a really robust debate within the Democratic caucus right now in terms of how you prioritize, even among, you know, even within one policy area on healthcare. And I think the politics behind each kind of competing faction and who's pushing what is really interesting. Because if you figure for the House Democratic leadership, whose focus really is on, you know, strengthening and making a lot of these key Obamacare subsidies permanent and a lot of those issues. Remember that, obviously, as you know, that, you know, First Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Affordable Care Act is her legacy domestic policy achievement. And certainly, especially if this does end up being her last term as speaker, she's going to want to tie that bow on really tight and, you know, seal that off for and leave it standing for future generations when she's out of office. But expanding Medicare benefits to dental, vision, and a lot of these other benefits was a huge priority of Senator Bernie Sanders, obviously a rival of President Biden during the 2020 presidential campaign, now the leader of the budget committee, who had a huge role in drafting kind of this blueprint of the $3.5 trillion blueprint of how things of the Democrats' reconciliation priorities. The expanding Medicare benefits has been his biggest priority, and it's something that the Senate Democrats agreed on as a group that was important to them and that the White House signed off as well. So once you start having to make choices, it's hard to we don't know yet where things will land at the end of the day. And the one interesting thing, too, that I want to point out on the expansion of Medicare benefits is that if you talk to experts, if you talk to CMS officials, it will take a considerable amount of time to kick in. I believe 2028 was the kind of the timeline that had been laid out by, I believe, House Democrats last week when they were going through the markups of the legislation. And as, you know, as obvious, 2028 is not 2022. So are people really going to be voting in favor of benefits that they're not going to get, even if they are signed into law, for another 6 years? And how do Democrats explain that? And does that end up really having the political impact, the political benefit that at the end of the day that Democrats really want by passing this reconciliation bill and signing it into law? So there's so many, you know, tricky landmines when it comes to healthcare. And it'll be one of really the most interesting policy areas to watch.
Aram, bring us home.
Hey, thanks, Justin. I really appreciate this talk in particular. Thank you, Sungmin Kim. I'm a big fan. And I wanted to bring up the recent energy and commerce bill, or I should say vote, that just happened around Medicare negotiating drug prices or not. There's kind of a story behind the story that I feel like it doesn't get told enough, which is basically the influence of lobbyists right now. And we sort of talk about it generally, but, you know, specifically right in this moment, there's just been an enormous influence. So like that vote, every Republican voted against it, which is its own thing. But there were also three Democrats, Peter Schrader and Rice, who voted against it. And a cursory look at their donations is really makes it really clear who it is who's funding their campaigns. In other words, in short, Big Pharma. Tens of thousands of dollars flowing to those three congressmen, or congresspeople, I should say. How do you as a journalist sort of negotiate the challenge of speaking about people's intentions? You know, it's so clear that they've received all this money, but can you sort of report that? How do you go about navigating that, you know, the influence of lobbying in D.C.? Thanks so much.
That's a really smart question, and it's such a salient one considering the ENC vote last week. I believe that there's been reporting out there as well that Senator Sinema is opposed to how the House Democrats had drafted their prescription drug provisions, and people pointed out about her own contributions from the pharmaceutical industry. You know, obviously, as objective journalists, we don't want to point out cause and effect if one doesn't exist, but we can give people all the information that is out there, and you know, their contributions, particularly from certain industries, is a huge part of that story. And that's why transparency when it comes to especially campaign finance measures and being able to access that information is critical. And it is certainly that part of that entire context that is worth, you know, giving to readers, you know, so, you know, this person voted against or for X topic, you know, are there, you know, industry groups that give to this person, you know, what is the workforce in his or her home state of this particular industry? And is that why that matters? So that's all like, that's all really super important context to provide to readers as we report on all these provisions that are making its way through Congress right now. So that's kind of how we try to handle it. And obviously, like I said, we don't want to, you know, say there is cause and effect if there is one, but all we can do is really just kind of provide all the necessary context, and then obviously asking the lawmakers themselves about what influenced their vote and the thinking behind their vote and their motivations.
Thank you for that question, Aram. Well, Sunmin Kim, what do you want to leave everybody with from the night?
This was a really fun crowd, and I loved all the questions. So I guess the one thing that I would leave the crowd with, beyond continuing to please read the Washington Post, is just that there's so much going on in Washington right now, and in terms of in terms of potential major changes in so many areas that touch every American's lives. So the more that people can be educated in what is going on with their own, what is going on with policymakers, whether it's at the White House, whether it's on Capitol Hill, and the more they can get involved in the process the more that they can get in the process and really get involved is a good thing, because they're, you know, I know things seem a little bit calmer under the Trump or under the Biden administration right now as compared to the Trump administration, but there's a lot of stuff going on that really matters for people's lives every day. And obviously we are going to try our best. We're obviously not going to meet that goal every day, but we as reporters will try our best every day to explain what is really going on in Washington and explain the impact of a lot of these changes that policymakers are considering. And hopefully, I just really hope that all that information really helps, you know, voters, constituents make their own decisions and really make key pivotal decisions in their own lives about whether it comes to healthcare or taxes or education or childcare or any one of these things that we're talking about today.
Well, that definitely describes our mission here at Politics and Media 101. By convening these conversations, bringing the guests to you, and giving anyone who wants to a chance to come and ask them a question, We hope that even if you don't agree with them, you can still come away with some information or perspectives or awareness that you find useful. As always, if you like or dislike what you hear, please visit our website, pm101.club or pm101.live. They both work and will get you to the same place where you can find past episodes, upcoming schedules, how to join us live and ask our guests questions, and more. You can also follow us on Twitter at PoliticsNMedia. That's at Politics, letter N, Media, where we post great stuff all the time. This has been Politics and Media 101. I'm Jeff Browning. On behalf of our co-founder, Justin Higgins, and our team, thank you very much for being here. We hope to see you and hear from you soon.